Prime Minister Scott Morrison talks endlessly about a gas-fueled recovery, and he backed that up in the budget with hundreds of millions for gas projects and so-called carbon capture schemes. We know it's all hot air that will only contribute to Australia generating even more hot air, but it always pays to analyse the arguments coming from the fossil fuel lobby and their accomplices in Parliament, so that the climate movement can move forward with even greater confidence. With us today to bust the gas myths is Penny McCall-Howard. Penny is the National Research Officer with the Maritime Union of Australia and a member of Solidarity. She's also the author of the book Environment, Labour and Capitalism at Sea, which won a global prize for the best book on the anthropology of work. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity, a revolutionary socialist group in Australia. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Melbourne. Penny, welcome.
Hi, David. Thanks for inviting me on.
A pleasure. Now, let's start off with talking about gas. From a climate perspective, Howard likes to suggest that gas is much more benign than coal. Can you sort of put this in perspective?
Well, gas is a fossil fuel. It's produced through the same geological mechanisms that coal is. They're often found together. That's why you get coal seam gas. You'll often have gas released when through the process of coal mining, or find those deposits together, or also with oil. So while it is true that burning gas has a lower emissions intensity than coal does, it's a fossil fuel that needs to be phased out in the same way that we're going to have to phase out the use of coal as well.
What sort of increase in temperature are we looking at if we fail to phase out gas? Well, for that matter, fossil fuels. Let's paint a bigger picture.
So there's a useful organization called the Climate Action Tracker that produce graphs that add up all the commitments that have been made by different countries around the world around reducing emissions, and have a look at how that compares to the kinds of emissions reduction that we need. So they say that the current policies that we're on, we're looking at potentially a 3.9 degree increase in the temperature, could be 2.9. Obviously, there's a bit of a range there. The current pledges and targets mean that we're heading to more like something of 2.4. Now, that's obviously a lot higher than where we need to get, which is 1.5. There was a little bit of improvement there after that climate summit that Joe Biden hosted, but it's important to emphasize that that was a very small level of improvement, about sort of maybe 10% or less of the kinds of improvements that we need. So there's still an enormous gap that exists in the kinds of pledges that we need and the kinds of real climate action that we need in order to reach that 1.5 degree limit that's absolutely necessary that we reach in order to preserve the life that we've developed on this planet.
There is a lot of skepticism around the recent G7 summit and the pledges made there, that those pledges simply don't add up. And there was Scott Morrison in Cornwall hanging around trying to be one of the cool kids as the guest of the G7. And he was clearly on the outer on the question of environment, compared to even the verbal promises of the Bidens and the Boris Johnsons of this world. Morrison is absolutely sticking to his guns on fossil fuel, and that obviously includes gas as well. So why are the Liberals so completely committed to a fossil fuel future when we know it's a disaster?
That's an interesting question, and I think there's two parts to the answer. One is that they're in a very material way, the Australian economy and the Australian ruling class and Australian governments, Commonwealth and state level, are really, really tied into the production of fossil fuels. We're the world's largest coal exporter. We're one of the world's largest gas exporters. Just recently became on par with Qatar on that. So our economy, revenues of Commonwealth and state governments, the donations that politicians get, all of those things are very, very tied into the fossil fuel industry. But I think in addition to that, there's a kind of political game that Scott Morrison is trying to play. He's trying to use a commitment to fossil fuel to pose as being a friend of the worker, that he's the one who's going to save working class jobs, that he's the one who's in favor of saving industries, heavy industry, and he gets around in his high vis and his hard hat, when really he's destroying the future of those workers, because those workers, just as much as anyone else, need a clear transition, and we just can't afford to let that transition happen as it is now, in a chaotic way that's driven by the market and at the whims of decisions that are being made in other parts of the world that we've got absolutely no control over.
We'll come back to the just transition, because that's a really big and important question, so let's spend some time on that later. But looking at, first of all, painting the bigger picture, okay, the Liberals are committed both economically and politically to fossil fuels, as you outlined. What's the alternative that's coming from Labour? Because we've got the Joel Fitzgibbon type Labour, and then we've got, well, I'm not quite sure who necessarily stands on the left of the debate inside the Labour Party. So given that there's going to be an election sometime either later this year or early next year, what alternative is being put up?
Well, I think that's still quite contested. Within the Labour Party, we've got the Labour Environment Action Network, who are obviously pushing for strong climate action. We had a recent vote in Parliament that was around the funding that was allocated in the federal budget to support fracking in the Northern Territory. Now, there were a couple of MPs, I know Jed Carney was one of them, who actually said, it was a motion that Zali Stegall put to actually remove that funding allocation from the federal budget. And there was a debate in the Labour caucus about whether they should support Zali Stegall's motion. Jed Carney and a few others argued that they should, but the caucus actually voted in favour of opposing that, so effectively allowing the federal government to make that funding to Northern Territory fracking. And Bill Shorten, to just give one example, argued that they'd already made that commitment in the last federal election campaign. On another recent question, the question of the $600 million for the Kurri-Kurri gas-fired power station, Chris Bowen, who's the spokesman on energy and climate for the Labour Party, he's come out against that, largely on market grounds, but he has come out to oppose that. Whereas, of course, there's quite a few other people in the Labour Party who have said that they support that project, or at the very least, they can't be seen to be opposing it. And they also don't have, they've committed to the net zero by 2050, but they're still don't have a clear target for 2030 at the moment. And they are, with the putting Chris Bowen into the position of climate and energy spokesperson to replace Mark Butler, they have tried to pivot to a more jobs approach to climate. They talk about, you know, the world's climate emergency is Australia's job opportunity. So they are trying that, but they're still doing that in quite a neoliberal sort of frame. So there's not the kind of real concrete investment, big projects that we actually need to see, kind of public ownership on the scale that we're actually seeing from Scott Morrison. So on the one hand, if you think about the electorates that are around that Hunter and Newcastle area, on the one hand, you've got the federal government saying we're going to put $600 million into building a new gas-fired power station. There isn't the weight of another project that the Labour Party is putting up or backing to counterpose that, to offer a real alternative to that. There are big projects proposed, big renewable energy projects proposed off the coast of Newcastle, big offshore wind projects with which have the backing of the unions. They're all being proposed by private companies and using funding from international investors to get going. So of course unions are going to be campaigning to make those good jobs, to kind of get the policies that we need to ensure that there's a good transition to those jobs. But it's not quite the same as the government stepping in and saying, we're going to be putting $600 million into publicly owned power stations.
Yes, there's a big offshore wind project mooted for Victoria as well, off the Gippsland coast, the Star of the Sea, which I've heard Friends of the Earth and unions talking about a number of times, but nothing seems to move forward. I'm being playing devil's advocate now. Why can't we rely on the private sector to put the investment in that's going to be necessary? After all, there are stories almost daily now in the financial media saying that the profitability of coal and gas is dropping like a stone, that coal mines in various parts of the world are being written down in value because the era of fossil fuels is over. And yet there's this huge gap between the rhetoric and the reality of a proper 100% renewable economy. Why isn't the private sector rushing in to make those profits?
Well, there's a couple different issues there. With the offshore wind projects, they can't actually go ahead unless the energy minister puts together and puts to parliament legislation that would allow a kind of licensing process for that offshore area. There's a particular issue for those big offshore wind projects that are at a scale that can actually replace whole coal-fired power station, 1 or 2 gigawatts of power just in a single project. But the broader question around public ownership, we've got a system now where at least Australia has actually started the process of planning what would a decarbonized electricity system look like. That's happening through the Australian Energy Market Operators Integrated System Plan. So on the one hand, you've got a planning process it's a neoliberal planning process, but it's quite a rigorous and quite a credible planning process. But on the other hand, the infrastructure that they're planning, the transmission, the generation, every aspect of it is owned by different competing companies who all sort of have a free go at proposing different projects and all have got their own investors that they're responding to, investment decisions that they're making. So it's extremely difficult for that system to be coordinated in the kind of way that you need to if you're going to radically overhaul it in the space of a decade or so. And so there's all sorts of examples where that's not working. So we've got a system where basically private developers propose building new projects. They're prospecting, they literally call it prospecting for land and good resources. And then they say, I want to build a project here. There's no coordination of the process of where do we actually want those projects to be built? Is the transmission grid ready to receive those projects? So we've gotten to situations in many parts of Australia where there's lots of projects in the process of being built, but not enough transmission to actually take them on. Now there's processes in place to try and designate renewable energy zones, build that transmission, but it all becomes extremely complex when you've got all sorts of different companies involved, all who've got different interests. I heard the other day, for example, that the transmission that's necessary to carry the electricity from the Snowy Hydro project that the government is spending a good few billion dollars on, that Transgrid actually isn't that interested in building the transmission for it. That's a company that was privatized by the New South Wales government about 5 or 6 years ago, I think. So on the one hand, there's a real structural issue with how is this transition going to take place. On the other hand, you've also got the jobs issue. If you've got publicly owned companies building new renewable energy projects, how you do a transition is quite straightforward. And there's actually a real possibility of that happening in Queensland, where most of the generation and a lot of the transmission are still in public hands. So those public companies have got the ability to just build new renewable energy and transfer workers across. In most of the rest of the country, I think except for West Australia, where it's largely privatized, that whole process becomes much more difficult. You've got these reverse auctions that are run by quite a few of the Labour governments that basically are an incentive. They offer a long-term contract that underpins a minimum price for renewable energy projects, but companies have to bid the lowest amount in terms of dollars per kilowatt to win those projects. So in order to win the subsidy, they underbid. That underbidding then locks them into literally decades of not having enough money to properly pay union contracts or workers, to have apprentices on site, to do the kind of training and have the kinds of WHS that they need. And it's also led to quite a few bankruptcies as well. And that's a system that's being used to incentivize the building of renewable energy all over the world. If anyone out there is interested in reading more about it, Trade Unions for Energy and Democracy have done a bit of an analysis about the problems with that way of incentivizing the construction of renewable energy. It does drive down the prices, but it also drives down the margin and the incentives for these projects to be built and makes it really difficult to have a just transition of the workforce. And what it does in many countries, it's actually privatizing electricity system. You're going from often state-owned, centrally run, coal-fired power-dependent grids to systems that are renewable energy, but it's all privately run renewable energy. It's the situation, for example, in South Africa. So we want a transition to zero emissions electricity, but we don't want to do that through privatizing the whole energy system. And that's a important political issue for the climate and environmental movement to get their heads around.
Yes, absolutely. It's worth reminding probably younger listeners that all the power stations, which are now beginning to come to the towards the end of their useful life, and the grids that connected them, were all built by state governments. They were all built by public intervention, and there's absolutely no reason why the public sector can't be used again.
Absolutely, it would be an extremely sensible way of carrying out the transition we need. The Labour Party does have a policy called Rewiring the Nation that's basically about building out the poles and wires for that integrated system plan. But the problem with that policy is that it is quite vague on the question of whether that will be what the mechanism will be. Will it be publicly owned? Will it be privately owned and incentivized? So that's something else that could also be improved.
I mentioned earlier on carbon capture and storage. It's part of the Liberal Party, we're dealing with climate, with technology fantasy that they like to talk about. It seems to me that carbon capture and storage, CCS, has been around as a pipe dream for a very long time now. Couldn't you take us through how it's meant to work and why it doesn't actually work?
Sure. I'm not an expert on this area, but I'll do my best. The concept is that in industrial processes, whether that's a power station or some other process where you're burning carbon dioxide, the concept is you would capture it and then you would bury it underground and then you wouldn't have to deal with it. The key thing there, of course, is that it's a justification to continue that industrial process that's producing the carbon dioxide in the first place. And that's really part of the political function of it. On a practical level, you need to have a kind of perfect geological underground basin that's sitting there that's airtight, or at least carbon dioxide tight, and ready to receive carbon dioxide, and a way of capturing it and transporting that carbon dioxide down far underground in a way that it's not going to come back out again. Now, there are places where it's a little more feasible to do that. And places where it's a bit more feasible to do that are places where they've actually already extracted gas from underground. And the Gorgon project that Chevron did over in West Australia was supposed to be a bit of a flagship venture for this. They were going to capture the carbon dioxide that was produced by their LNG plant and pump it back underground. And actually doing that was a condition of the approval of that plant by the West Australian government. Now, it's despite that, the Western Australian government's been extremely slow to actually compel them to operate the thing. It spent years not working. It's not sufficiently reported. And the little reporting that we've got has indicated that they've only been able to capture and store a very tiny percentage of the carbon dioxide that's been produced through that process. So there you've got the sort of best possible situation of a carbon dioxide producing process sitting right next to a good geological formation, and they haven't been able to do it. Now, our coal-fired power stations were not built next to perfect underground geological formations for storing carbon dioxide. It's just not why they're built where they were. So in a lot of cases, you'd be talking about actually building a new coal or gas-fired plant in the place where you could actually do this, or close enough that you could transport it. And that's just crazy. It's a crazy thing to do at this point in the climate crisis, and also at this point when we have the technology that can do the job of certainly producing electricity and lots of other replacing of different other processes that are putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now. We've got much better technologies, much cheaper technologies, much more efficient technologies of doing that now than this carbon capture and storage business.
Perhaps we can move on now to the question of the just transition. Now, when we say just transition, we often just put it together as one phrase, and we think it's about the workers in the fossil fuel industries, and that's a crucial element of the debate, and we'll come to that in a moment. But I suppose, first of all, I'd like to talk about the transition, because there are industries that exist at the moment that employ people that use gas, for whom it would be a major problem to move from gas. And a number of people in the union movement who are, shall we say, less supportive of the climate movement have talked about this as saying that the climate movement doesn't really understand reality, that we want to see workplaces shut down, workers chucked out of jobs. To what extent is that a real problem, and what kind of solutions can we look at?
So the places, obviously the main place we're using coal right now is in coal-fired power stations, and then, but actually the vast majority of it is exported. In terms of gas, there's some quite different ways that gas is being used. It's used in households. Certainly in Victoria, gas is piped straight into a very large portion of households, and people use it for cooking and heating and probably heating hot water systems. Now, all of those things can be done with electricity. And in fact, converting household use to electricity has a lot of health benefits too, because there's been some reports come out recently, but it's also been a longstanding issue that actually burning gas in your home is not great for the health. And in particular, it's not good for the health of children. The other places where gas is used is for in power stations. Interestingly enough, despite the rhetoric from Morrison about we need to ramp up the use of gas in order to fill the gaps of power supplied by renewable energy, the use of gas has declined quite a lot over the past few years, where there have been more and more renewables on the grid. It's come down very, very significantly. And what that means is that we've already got gas-fired power stations sitting there idle. So just to give an example, in 2011, there was about 35 petajoules of gas consumed for power generation in New South Wales. That's come down to less than 10 in 2020. So there's a huge amount of capacity that's sitting there and sitting there idle. There is a role for filling in some of those gaps while we've got this chaotically planned system that we have at the moment, but good planning can overcome those problems. We don't need another gas-fired power station. And then we've also got industrial processes that use gas for heat and power, and we've got industrial processes that use gas as a feedstock, like fertilizer and ammonia, explosives, some of those kinds of things, other chemicals as well. The issue that we've got with gas production, and I think this is partly where the kind of the struggle around Morrison's gas-fired recovery comes in. As I mentioned before, gas is a fossil fuel, and the gas basins that we've historically relied on, particularly the ones off the coast of Victoria in the Bass Strait, are being depleted quite quickly, and particularly go into a pretty sharp decline once you get to 2030. So part of what the gas-fired recovery is about maintaining that domestic production of gas to meet our current needs. And there's a really great graph that's in the Energy Market Operator's projection of gas use that shows gas production dropping sharply after 2030, but our gas needs carrying on into the future, which is a reflection of actually what's hardwired into our houses, into our industries, and into our economy. So Morrison's solution is to open up the Beetaloo Basin in the Northern Territory, open up Narrabri, open up other brand new gas basins to keep that going. But of course, everyone else knows that we've actually got to transition those industries away from it. So households are a great place to start, and that's a huge source of jobs there. Actually converting households to reduce the amount of gas, to insulate them better, to make them healthier and more comfortable to live in is a very labor-intensive prospect. Gas power, again, the role that plays in the grid can be replaced with batteries and renewable energy. And the more battery production that can be done in Australia using all sorts of minerals that are already produced here could certainly meet that need as well and be another source of jobs as well. The industries that are harder to abate, that's, you know, a lot of that is the subject of research and development, and that needs to be supported, and that needs to be developed, and that needs to be developed on the basis of human need, not just the basis of companies sort of racing to see who's going to get the next new profitable technology. Now, on the question of what, that's a transition question, the question of justice, certainly there's a question of the workforce, of ensuring that the current workforce in these industries can get a guaranteed transition, can get the training that they need, but also that those new industries that are being created, that those are good union jobs, that they've got the right apprenticeship ratios, that they're covered with the kinds of agreements that we've seen built up over decades in other industries as well. And there's also the broader question of the communities that are potentially disproportionately affected as well. And in investing in broader social improvements. So, you know, improving education is, of course, a great source of jobs, improving healthcare, making the kinds of investments that we need to make communities who might be negatively impacted from this to ensure that they can actually benefit. That's not profitable, but that is the kind of big investment that we need in order to ensure that the transition that we have is actually a just transition.
How does the politics of this play out, particularly in the union movement? Because there are sections of the union movement, principally the mining section of the CFMEU, who have to some extent fallen in line, it seems to me, with the coalition or even the One Nation agenda, that coal miners' jobs are at risk from crazy inner-city greenies who have no understanding of reality. How do we try and break down what is clearly a very damaging division within the union movement?
I suppose there's a couple of different answers to that. Certainly, building a climate movement that's an inclusive movement that understands not just the concerns and fears that workers have, but the fact that they are materially true. And I think we've seen the school strike movement make big strides in that direction. So as long as the climate movement doesn't actually concern itself with a just transition or with workers' rights, that just entrenches the problem. So the more that we can have a climate movement that takes those things on board, the bigger and broader and stronger that movement can be. And it can actually play a role in ensuring that we do have the kind of just transition that I described earlier, that those people get involved with those fights. And we had a great speech from Alan Hicks, the National Secretary of the Electrical Trades Union in Sydney a couple of weeks ago, who made exactly that argument to the 10,000 or so young people that were there in front of Sydney Town Hall. So the climate movement on one hand is important. The actions of government are also important, because as much as the climate movement can say, look, we can have these jobs, we can have these industries, until they're real and until they're tangible, it's really difficult for workers to believe that or see that. And many unions do respond to that pressure. And it's not those views held by parts of the leadership of the union movement are unfortunately reflected in some of their membership. That's why we've seen some of the electoral results that we saw in the 2019 election. And I suppose also the role that other unions can play in actually developing what some of those alternative jobs are, in working out what does a union climate, what does a working class climate movement actually look like, and make that a real living, breathing thing. All of those things hopefully can contribute to moving our politics in a positive direction. But the role that Morrison plays is a huge obstacle. The role that One Nation plays is a huge obstacle. They're basically telling workers lies about the future and trying to win their votes that way. And it's incredibly destructive, and something that we do need to work really hard to try and put a stop to.
Many of those on the right who bleat on about jobs in coal mining areas as if they've always loved coal miners have nothing to say about the car industry being scrapped a few years ago, and also have nothing to say when coal mining jobs are being lost here and now because of a fall in the price of coal or because of other market mechanisms. Do you have any sense about how many jobs are being lost right now under the existing Morrison set of circumstances?
I'm not sure about jobs being lost right now, but certainly there's a huge issue with casualization across the coal mining industry in Queensland and in New South Wales. And that's something that the miners' union has taken up, and it's something that the government and One Nation have done their best to block. So that's a really clear example there of, you know, politicians who on the one hand say they're in favor of coal miners' jobs and of supporting coal miners, but when it comes down to it, they're supporting the boss. And when workers organize to try and improve permanency, and of course, improve permanency leads to a direct improvement in safety on the job as well. And my understanding is there's going to be a report coming out soon on a mine explosion that they say was, you know, largely due to the fact that there were a lot of labor hire workers in this dangerous workplace. But the government doing everything it can to support companies using labor hire workers and obstruct the efforts by unions to increase permanency and increase safety in the coal mining industry. So that's an important issue to organize around for sure. But I mean, the one of the other big obstacles that we've got is we do have a union movement that is at pretty low density in the private sector. And as long as we've got workers that are not confident, that rely on, you know, what their boss tells them about their future, what might give them hope, what should give them fear, then we will always be stuck, I think, in some of these really, really toxic debates. And so the whole question of actually increasing the union organization across the whole workforce, I think, is also a really important aspect of trying to build the confidence of the union movement to take these questions on and to try and win the just transition that we need. And I think it's not a coincidence that unions that are industrially stronger, whose members are a bit more organized and a bit more confident, are ones that have also been a bit more confident to take on the question of climate and to look ahead at, you know, what could their industries look like, and the unions playing a role in actually trying to push that transition forward.
You mentioned the recent climate strike. It was fantastic to see tens of thousands back on the streets around the country after the hiatus of 2020, not quite as strong as 2019, but of course we have to rebuild the momentum and the organisation. Nonetheless, tens of thousands on the streets. I know here in Melbourne, I saw probably banners and flags and contingents from 8 or 10 different unions. It was very inspiring. So what's the next step for the climate movement?
Yeah, so there's a couple different things. Obviously, the climate strikes have now started to be a really good focus for the climate movement as a whole. And my understanding is that there's discussions underway about having a next strike in September or October. And that's going to lead into the next round of global climate discussions, the COP Conference of Parties that's going to be held in Glasgow, I believe, starting on the 1st of November. And that's an important one because that's where companies are supposed to go and make new pledges and also actually make their own just transition plans. And of course, hopefully, there'll be pressure on Australia to do both of those things. But I suspect that Scott Morrison will be doing his best not to have either. And of course, in the meantime, we need to do everything we can to oppose some of these measures that were in the federal budget. So things like that gas-fired power station, the drilling that's proposed in the Northern Territory, the Narrabri gas project, which might also be getting more funding announced towards the end of this year as well. So there's certainly lots for the climate movement to be active on now.
And obviously, alliances to be strengthened. You mentioned the Narrabri option. That's going to be drilled on Aboriginal land against the wishes of local Aboriginal people. So building alliances between climate activists, unionists and Indigenous activists will be absolutely crucial.
That's right. So it's been great to see that there's three maritime union branches in New South Wales, Newcastle, Sydney and Port Kembla. And they've put out a joint statement opposing that project and pledging to work in solidarity with traditional owners, Gamilaroi and Gomeroi, in that area. And hopefully we'll be able to develop that solidarity further through some kind of, you know, unions going up to visit that area and develop those links further and to try and push that solidarity as much as we can.
And I suppose my last question is about Workers for Climate Action. I understand you're involved in Workers for Climate Action in Sydney. I know there's an active group in Melbourne. And what can people do? How can people get involved?
Yeah, so Workers for Climate Action in Sydney has been going for a couple of years now. It kicked off a few months before the 2019 climate strike as a way to try and get unionists and unions more involved with that strike, which has been largely successful. Certainly, we have managed to increase that support and awareness. Just recently in Sydney, we were able to get a School Strike for Climate speaker on the platform for the May Day rally here, which is historically quite a big event. It's always a big event on the union calendar, as well as Ian Brown from Gamilaroi Next Generation was also part of that platform as well. We're ramping up. We've got another meeting on the 28th of June to talk about position to Narrabri. We've got a statement for unionists to encourage any unionists to sign to oppose the gas-fired recovery and the Narrabri project and the Kuri Kuri gas-fired plant as well. So, and as the dates are announced for the next climate strike, we'll be organising for that as best we can too.
And I'm sure people can find details for Workers for Climate Action in both Sydney and Melbourne on Facebook. So thanks for your time, Penny. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks very much, David.